It's the morning show. I'm John Munson. This week marks the 20th anniversary of the death of Wisconsin's Chris Farley, the actor and funny man who entertained millions with his unique brand of comedy. In this edition of Wisconsin Weekend, we talk about the comedian's Madison roots, his life and career, and the movies and SNL skits that are worth rewatching this weekend with friends and family. What Farley skit still gives you laughing fits? What was his best movie or cameo appearance, do you think? And what's your favorite Chris Farley memory? Share those with us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. Jonathan Pollock is a history instructor and pop culture expert at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us this morning to help us remember Chris Farley. Jonathan, welcome back to the morning show.
Good to see you this morning, John. Thanks a lot.
Well, it's kind of hard to believe, but we've been without Wisconsin's Chris Farley for 20 years now. What is it about Farley, do you think, that still has us talking about him two decades after his death?
Well, I mean, he's, you know, it's such a kind of classic arc for an American celebrity. He's often compared to John Belushi, who preceded him on Saturday Night Live, that he came out of the Midwest. He was this kind of big guy with a whole lot of energy, you know, did some really just put himself out there on SNL. I mean, if you watch the old clips, he just leaves everything on the stage. And then on to a film career. I mean, there's, you know, SNL has been with us for over 40 years. And for every person who was kind of a bit player on SNL to become a featured player is kind of a big obstacle. And then to go from Saturday Night Television to movies is like really big. Not everybody does that. And there are lots of, you know, now obscure SNL stars who just, you know, never went anywhere. But Chris Farley, no, he hit the big time, had a bunch of successful movies, and then died really young, which always kind of gives people pause and so on. I mean, I think here in Wisconsin, you know, he's sort of us. I mean, he had his Wisconsin accent was a big part of his character much of the time. On SNL sketches and in his movies, he's wearing Packers gear. He's wearing something from Marquette or from UW. So in some ways, I think he was kind of a symbol of the state, and that's why we here in Wisconsin, you know, remember his passing so much. Why this whole week, the papers and in conversations, people have been talking about Chris Farley.
So I take it you were a fan.
I was kind of a fan. I mean, I think I liked him more on, and this is, you know, people say this all the time about SNL actors who go on, but I really did like him better on SNL than in the movies. I mean, I felt like his. Like, he was kind of so over the top that like, in the small dose of, like, seeing him in a sketch, I mean, like, one of my favorites was the Chippendale sketch he did with Patrick Swayze, where they're both auditioning to be dancers. I mean, there, that's an incredible bit. I mean, that's just one of the greatest things. Or when he's the fanboy interviewing Paul McCartney, and all he can say is, like, how amazing it is to be interviewing Paul McCartney. So those things, I in small doses, I liked him a lot. For a whole movie, I wasn't that huge a fan of his movies, I guess.
Well, you know, it wasn't that true for quite a few of the SNL stars who went on to make movies. I mean, good in small doses, but man, an hour and a half, 2 hours of that, yeah, a little
right.
bit much to take.
Yeah, it's kind of the format of like an improv show versus a movie that. In an improv show, your character has to come on like right away and make a big impression, and your audience has to get a whole set of ideas that are wrapped up in this person. But in a movie, you've got like 90 minutes, a couple hours to kind of unwind, and if they make that really big impression at the beginning, like, where do they go? Like, how do they build on that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, I mean, Farley didn't really, I'm trying to think now, one of the problems with SNL characters or actors going on to movies is they'll take their stock character and try and make a movie out of it. And I don't think Farley really did that. I mean, he didn't, you know, I don't recall there being like a Matt Foley movie or anything like that. So at least he steered clear of that pitfall.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he was just like so intense and so forth. And, but yeah, just great on SNL.
Yeah, I mean, he just ate up the stage on SNL. I mean, when he was there, I mean, he was the focus of whatever the skit was, no matter who else was in it.
Well, and even early on, I was talking this week to a friend of mine who directed him at the Arc in Madison at the Improv Theater here. And she said, yeah, that early on, I mean, then he would have been like in his early mid-20s, that he already had had really memorable characters and was just, you know, just far and away one of the top players in that group.
So how would you describe his style of comedy?
I would say manic. I think that's a pretty good one.
Oh, yeah.
That he was just, he was a very physical comedian. You know, he would just kind of throw his body around up there. He's very loud. I mean, you know, I sort of think of him as just like his characters yelled a lot. You know, they weren't subtle really in any way. So he's very brash. He's very over the top. I guess that's more than one word there.
Well, that's okay. So what was it about Chris Farley that just made us laugh so much?
Well, I think it was. I think there's a few things. I mean, first of all, anytime you've got somebody who's going to be so physical and so over the top, you're kind of watching that person and you're thinking he's not really going to do that. You know, like in the Chippendale sketch, you're thinking he's not going to tear his shirt off, but he does. And so consistently, Chris Farley like does the thing you think he's not going to do, and that makes it laugh. But I think also, and I think more in his movies where this came out, where you got to see him on screen a little bit more, is that he kind of abruptly went from this really brash and over the top character to like this very loving one. It was this kind of quick transition, and from talking to people who knew him in Madison when he was here and when he'd come back to visit, that was another thing that on at least a very local level that's certainly here for people who knew him in the Madison area, and I imagine people who went to Marquette with him said that he was extremely close to his family. That a friend of mine who was working for the Catholic diocese here in Madison said that he was very generous to Catholic charities, that she remembers seeing him at Mass, sitting in the front row. And so that kind of duality where he's this, you know, kind of, you know, Midwestern family man part of the time, but then otherwise is on stage and he's like a totally different person. I think that's kind of fascinating to see people like that.
Well, we'd be, you know, we've mentioned this, and Chris Farley, obviously Midwestern roots. You mentioned that he brought his Wisconsin style of speech to his comedy. He wore Packers gear and UW logo wear and Marquette. So, I mean, he was a kind of a billboard for Wisconsin. How else did we see his Midwest persona come out in his comedy?
Well, it's, I mean, the Midwest on screen is kind of, when you get a character and you find out they're from the Midwest, it's often like a sign they're like sort of a well-meaning doofus. I mean, the Midwest has this kind of, it's this kind of okay image on screen. I mean, I think Midwesterners in movies tend to come off better, or Midwestern stereotypes are less vicious than like Southern stereotypes or maybe stereotypes of people from New York or California. But the Midwestern stereotype is someone, you know, you're not going to have like a really driven Midwesterner most of the time. You're going to have somebody who's kind of grounded. You're going to have somebody, you know, Midwesterners are going to come across as kind of like unsophisticated, kind of a rube in the city kind of thing. And in that way, also, Chris Farley's characters were kind of like that. They kind of, you know, they kind of bumbled around and didn't have, you know, they didn't have the social graces that, you know, they might have had from New England. But they were, you know, in the words that we use to describe presidential candidates, the kind of person you'd want to have a beer with. So that's another way that through his characters that he played and the way he inhabited them, that Chris Farley represented his Midwesternness.
We have an email from Jim in Milwaukee who writes, Farley was a true comic. He used his mind and body to humor us. I'm proud he was from Wisconsin. I'm curious, Jim says, what impact did he have on other comics?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I've thought a lot about how, and Farley, when he was alive, talked about how he was influenced by John Belushi and John Candy, and how their comedy really influenced his. Who's he influenced? I'm honestly, I can't think of anyone like him who's come up since.
Give it some thought. We have to break for the news, and maybe we'll come up with something by the end of the news break. We're remembering Chris Farley 20 years after his passing. Madison-born Chris Farley, a big comedian, very funny man, and made a lot of people laugh. Want to know what you think. What's your favorite Chris Farley bit? We'll play some clips as we go through the hour. Get a hold of us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also reach us by email. The address is ideas@wpr.org. Jonathan Pollock is my guest. I'm John Munson, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
I am El Nino. All other tropical storms must bow before El Nino. Yo soy El Nino. For those of you who don't habla Espanol, El Nino is Spanish for the Nino.
It's The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. We're remembering Chris Farley today, 20 years after his passing. Jonathan Pollock is a history instructor and pop culture expert at Madison Area Technical College. He joins me as we talk about our favorite Chris Farley moments. Of course, that bit, El Nino, was a very typical Chris Farley bit. 800-642-1234, the number to call. We're already getting some calls, Jonathan Pollock. I still laugh at that El Nino gag, especially when it gets to the end. And, you know, that's Spanish for, the Nino. Why can't talk show hosts tell jokes timing? But that was his comic timing and his ability to just completely, you know, leave himself out on the stage, as you put it, really made him a great presence on Saturday Night Live. We've got some more clips to play, but with a lot of phone calls coming in, let's take some calls. Drew is with us in Lake Mills. Drew, go ahead.
Great to have Mr. Pollock as your guest here this morning. I can confirm one of his comments about Chris Farley being a larger than life character, both on the stage and in real life. Many years ago, when he was at the height of his career, way before the Overture Center, right around the corner from the existing Overture Center was a pizza place called Rosino's and also Dottie's Dumpling Dowry. And my wife and I used to travel into Madison to see a lot of shows and on State Street and see, go to the museums down there. And late one night after a show, we stopped into this pizza place to get a slice of pizza and something to drink. And Chris Farley was in there with a friend. And we walked in, and I see this large man with his friend, and just sitting there looking at him, I knew it kind of was him, but just watching his antics, and he was just eating, taking these pieces of giant slices of pizza and just eating them and just arms flailing. And I'm like, Diane, don't turn around, my wife. I said, but that's Chris Farley behind you. And she turned around, and it was just seeing him just having a night out with a friend, just in a very sparsely populated pizza place, he was just like he was on stage. I just couldn't believe it. I didn't go up and talk to him and say hi there, because he was just out with a friend and I didn't want to disturb him. But I can absolutely confirm that he was that kind of a person in real life and not just on stage, not just in front of, you know, an audience.
All right, Drew, thanks for the call. Jonathan Pollock?
Yeah, that was great. I mean, thanks for the Rosino's story. I haven't thought about that place in years. I used to live like down the street from that. That bears out what I heard from other people I've talked to who were in Madison at that time and ran into him or knew him like back when he was in school. Although I gotta say, while I think Drew's idea is generally sound, that generally you see somebody who's famous in a restaurant and they're just kind of having a slice late at night, just kind of leave him alone. I was talking to a friend of mine who was in line for a movie here in Madison, and Chris Farley was waiting to see the same movie, and a friend of hers did Chris Farley's Paul McCartney interview bit like in front of Chris Farley, and Farley loved it, and he just like totally chimed in, and it was like this kind of hilarious interchange. But yeah, no, that's a great story, and that really that kind of gets to how he was both on stage and off.
Thanks for that call. Let's take another one. This time we'll go to Matt in Madison. Oh, I love the alliteration there. Matt, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, another great sketch from SNL that I was hoping you guys would touch on is when Farley played the Chicago Bears fan along with, I think it was George Wendt from Cheers and maybe one other guy. And that was so over the top where he's like choking on a rack of ribs or something as they're talking about the Bears and Mike Ditka.
Yeah. The Bears.
Yeah, the super fans. Yeah, no, that's a great sketch. And of course, you know, a Chicago one more specifically than a Wisconsin one, but still kind of a quintessentially, you know, Midwestern one. Yeah, that sketch was that was a fantastic sketch. It was a recurring one. Whenever George Wendt was on the show and other times that he wasn't, they'd kind of bring that out. Yeah, I mean, that was it was really hilarious because, yeah, I mean, the other thing, and this is kind of like the pizza story earlier. I mean, Farley would have to eat like large amounts of greasy food on stage. I mean, I think those are like real Italian beef sandwiches and kielbasa and whatnot. And he and the other guys would be like eating through the sketch. Yeah, no, those were just whenever that came up, that was always going to be a good sketch. Their idolization of Mike Ditka and the Bears and Chicago sports in general, those were excellent.
Matt, thanks so much for your call. And I know Chicago fans who really were like that skit too. So I mean, it seemed to me pretty close to the truth. Probably Packer fans would be the same way. Let's talk for just a moment about the parallels, because people often draw them, between Chris Farley and John Belushi in terms of how they lived and died and the impact that they had on Saturday Night Live and on comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of similarity. I mean, they both came out of... they both came out of Chicago, was where they really launched their careers and where they, you know, kind of continued to maintain an apartment and live there and hang out. They had a similar kind of physical comedy where, again, they just put everything up there. Their personal lives were full of the same kinds of excess that I believe they died of the same, like cocaine and heroin combination. At roughly the same point in their lives when they were in their early 30s. So those similarities are really there. I think the difference is that, like, Belushi, when I think about John Belushi's roles, I think of him as somebody who is generally, like, angrier. I mean, Chris Farley could certainly play angry characters, and his characters could get all wound up and angry, but it seems like Belushi had, like, a little more of an edge to him, and Farley... you know, had his characters had more of this kind of goofball thing to him. And Belushi's characters, I don't think of as being like really goofball. I mean, like Bluto Butarski and Animal House and so forth. It's like, they're not really goofballs exactly. They're like something a little different. But they had a similar style of, they both, you know, very physical comedy, a lot of comedy with food and eating, both pretty loud, kind of characters. I mean, like, I don't see Chris Farley pulling off the Blues Brothers. I mean, he couldn't restrain himself that way. You know, it would have been a very different thing. So I think that's the big difference. But yeah, they also, you know, took their, you know, improv training in Chicago and elsewhere and used that as a springboard to get on SNL, perfect the ability to create a character very quickly who's instantly relatable and connects with an audience. And then also stand out as two of the more successful SNL alums in films.
Well, we've been talking about Chris Farley's work on Saturday Night Live. He was on the show for 5 years. And, you know, he had a lot of memorable characters. You've already heard people refer to a few of them. One of the ones that I remember the most And this actually came up in the one of the pre-production meetings we had, is inspirational, motivational speaker Matt Foley. Matt Foley was a real person in Chris Farley's life, but let's listen to Chris Farley as a motivational speaker Matt Foley.
Now, as your father probably told you, my name is Matt Foley, and I am a motivational speaker. Now let's get started by letting me give you a little bit of a scenario of what my life is all about. First off, I am 35 years old. I am divorced, and I live in a van down by the river.
A van down by the river kind of became, you know, everybody remembers that line. That was from a 1993 sketch. When I look at those on YouTube, I think they're as funny now as they were back then. He was just so over the top. What was it about Farley that allowed him to bring a character to life in that way?
I mean, I think it's just because he totally committed to it. I mean, the whole premise of that the... at least the first Matt Foley sketch, as I remember it, that these parents have teenage kids. I think it was like David Spade and Melanie Hutzel they're staying out late and they're causing trouble and they want to bring their kids back in line and they don't seem to be having any effect, and so they bring a motivational speaker into their house. And I think that's part of Chris Farley's comedy, is that it's like this big kind of comedy. And a motivational speaker is going to be somebody who's got this huge presence, who's working on a stage in an auditorium or a high school gym or something like that. But just the whole premise of having somebody like that in your living room is itself funny. Like, how would that work out? Well, it's funny. Explaining it doesn't sound especially funny, but that's, I think, how it works. And so I think that was really the key to that character, was just that you've got that big... that big character and some of the cliches and exaggerations of motivational speakers who go around, but it's in somebody's living room, and so that way he's getting right up into the other characters' faces, and I think also in that sketch it's one of those where the other actors in the scene break character, where they just start laughing.
Yeah, because he breaks everybody up
because they can't stand it. And I think in some of the stories I've heard from people, I mean, even the first caller and some of the folks I talked to this week, that was one of the things that they found really funny about him, was that if they'd see him out in a restaurant or a bar or something like that, that he was capable of doing that. That most of us, if we're in a kind of joking mood when we're out with our friends, we're kind of speaking at this level or loud enough to be heard in a crowded room, but we're not, performing quite that much. But the ability to perform, to do those like really big gestures and big characters and really tight circumstances, is part of what made him really funny.
Let's take another call. First, I want to give the number again. People can join us, share their memories of the late Chris Farley. John is with us in Green Bay. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Great show. Just an observation that I've made. I teach at a technical college, and I teach sales and marketing, and we use a lot of Chris Farley clips from Tommy Boy. And what I've found is over the years, the younger students tend to relate more to that character than they maybe do from some of the SNL days, because it's getting to be so long ago. And I think just my comment is, I think he's just such a lovable, kind of honest to a fault character, that in the kind of what you said before about, he probably couldn't play some of the roles that Belushi played and things like that, but it makes him a very endearing character. And I think, again, my students relate to it, even if they really didn't know his background or anything. I can play those clips and they're pretty much just rolling on the floor laughing. So good show. Thanks, guys.
John, thanks for your call. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can join us. Jonathan Pollock, Tommy Boy.
Yeah, I mean, as the caller pointed out, one of the great things about that film and Farley's films, and even I think his SNL characters, is that they're not complex, that you can come in without any kind of prior knowledge of who Chris Farley is, encounter him fresh, and just find him really funny, because he's got that he's just, you know, kind of goofy and enthusiastic and so on. And because he just, you know, commits so completely to whoever he's playing, that even an audience that didn't grow up with him and, you know, didn't see him on SNL can just jump right in and identify with those characters.
Well, let's take another call here about Tommy Boy, and we'll go next to Dan, who's calling us in Drummond. Gee, we had Matt from Madison. Now we've got Dan from Drummond. This is the Alliteration Hour on Wisconsin Public Radio. Dan, good morning. You're on the air.
Well, I refer to Tommy Boy, and the scene that I loved was where they're driving. They hit a buck, and they think it's dead, so they put it into the car with them. And they're driving along, and all of a sudden, the darn thing comes back to life. And that has to be, for me, one of the funniest scenes in that movie.
Yeah, that was, you know, that was a great moment. And maybe you have to be from Wisconsin to really find that as humorous as we do. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah, that I'm thinking that that's again, that's part of that kind of the upper Midwest on screen. You take something that's a fairly common event and sort of a dangerous one, but then that same kind of thing I was talking about earlier, where you think, well, that couldn't happen, and then it does, or in that case, you're kind of thinking, well, what would happen if the buck's not really dead, and then it comes back, makes for great comedy.
Yeah, Dan, thanks so much for that call. Jim is next, calling from Elkhorn. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, you're talking on about the Tommy Boy movie. I've been in a sales training setting where they used that as part of the model for, you know, what you should and shouldn't do in training, which made it lighthearted. And there were some good lessons out of it. The other thing about that movie is if people in Wisconsin notice, he wears a Marquette rugby jacket in it. And I was going to UW-Madison about the time that he was at Marquette and apparently played against him. Don't remember it, but people in the rugby community in Madison and Milwaukee, you know, there's pictures floating around right now of him playing. He was apparently, you know, for being kind of an overweight guy, he was a reasonably good athlete, and you saw that in some of the comedy too.
Yeah,
Jonathan Pollock.
Yeah, no, he was very energetic and very physical, and yeah, I knew about his that he played rugby for Marquette. I think that's one of the things he was very proud of. I think that's one of the things that kind of endears him to certainly like a local and regional audience that he had. That kind of connection. And I'm thinking now, this is a couple of people who've talked about Tommy Boy in sales. And that, I mean, that seems to me, that's like part of being, trying to sell something successfully is you have to believe in it. You know, if you don't believe in your product and you're saying, well, I just, you know, I gotta make rent this month. And so I got to do this thing where I sell this stuff to people that, you know, I don't know how it works. I don't really like it. It's not a great product. You're not going to be very successful. Where if you put in like a Chris Farley level commitment to the play, you're much more likely to win people along, to bring them, you know, to convince them that this is something they want to have, and you're going to be better at it. So, yeah. So, ironically, you know, if managers continue using Chris Farley clips and so forth, that in some ways Chris Farley really will be known as kind of a motivational speaker in helping people sell better 20 years after his passing.
We're talking about the life and career of Chris Farley, who passed 20 years ago. It just doesn't seem like it's been that long. Jonathan Pollock is my guest this hour. We're discussing Farley's career and what it meant, and just kind of wondering what you think. This segment will be a little shorter than normal because we have Wisconsin Life coming up, but still probably time to get in a phone call or two, although we have some more clips to play as well. I want to get to the one from Beverly Hills Ninja before the end of the hour because we haven't mentioned that movie yet. Anyway, we're going to take a break for the news, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Chris Farley. You can join us at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You remember when you were with the Beatles and you were supposed to be dead, and there's all these clues that, like, he'd play some song backwards and it'd say, like, Paul is dead, and everyone thought that you were dead or something.
Yep.
That was a hoax, right?
Chris Farley interviewing Paul McCartney. Jonathan Pollock is my guest. We're talking about Chris Farley, who passed away 20 years ago. Jonathan Pollock is a history instructor and pop culture expert at Madison Area Technical College. Jonathan, that particular bit, we referenced it earlier. I mean, it was just so, it was one of those things where you're laughing, but it's kind of, you're kind of cringing at the same time because you're just kind of embarrassed for him. And he's doing it on purpose. You know that, but still.
Yeah, I mean, you're cringing a bit, but at the same time, he's just, he's so happy to be there with Paul McCartney. He's obviously such a huge super fan that that even though he's blowing the interview and not making a whole lot of sense, and of course, ironically, in that clip, not even giving his idol any time to speak, that's what makes it so great, is that he's just so sincerely into it.
It many years later, I was reminded of that as I was attempting to interview Greg Allman. We're going to run out of time here before we get to everything we really could. I want to play one more SNL clip. This is another favorite. Chris Farley plays contributor Bennett Brower on SNL's Weekend Update. And he uses a whole lot of air quotes. Let's listen to that.
Well, maybe I don't look the part. I'm not svelte. I don't look comfortable on camera. I'm not savvy. I don't understand what's going on in the news. I'm not likable. I don't get along with people. When I go to work, I don't make eye contact.
Those air quotes, you know, even though we don't have the video here, but you can almost hear them dropping into place and see his hands up and the exaggerated movements. That was such a funny bit.
Yeah, that was great that he's able to put across the concept of air quotes and we're able to listen on the radio and get exactly what's going on. That's skillful.
We mentioned a number of callers mentioned Tommy Boy, but Farley had another film, 1997's Beverly Hills Ninja. How did that compare to Tommy Boy in terms of its success? What's your take on that film?
I mean, I got to say, 97, I had a little kid, and so at that point, like, going to movies pretty much fell off the map for a few years. That was, like, the late 90s. I got, like, nothing on movies. I mean, I don't think it was as big a film as Tommy Boy. I mean, I think Tommy Boy is probably his top-grossing film, his best-remembered film, you know, probably, like, the best film he was in. Beverly Hills Ninja was, yeah, I mean, that one was, I think, the last full film he was in. He might have had some cameo and something else where they shot some scenes and they put it in. But yeah, I don't remember it being like especially well reviewed. I mean, I don't remember that being the kind of movie where my wife and I were just like, okay, we got to get a sitter for this one because, you know, Beverly Hills Ninja's in theaters now. I mean, I'm sure it's got its fans out there. I'm sure there's, I don't know, a whole bunch of phone lines going to light up with hardcore with people who like act out Beverly Hills Ninja on a regular basis. And
I don't think I want to know about that if it's the case.
Canceling my subscription to WPR, but but yeah, I don't think it had that kind of impact. I mean, I think it was kind of, you know, his career. I mean, he kind of started strong, and then probably as the substance abuse kind of kicked in, I mean, I think he kind of struggled more. I mean, I think that kind of manic behavior that we talked about turned more into flailing, that he just, you know, he was kind of, he couldn't get a grip on it. And I think Beverly Hills Ninja came out at that point in his life.
Well, we've got a comment from Janet I wanted to be sure to get to. Janet from Madison called to ask, is Farley's comedy more appealing to men than women? I don't care for it myself, and we haven't heard from any women this hour.
I think that's a great observation. Yeah, I mean, one of the other things, I think part of that, several of the women I talked to who met Chris Farley, either as when they were in high school or once he had launched his career, mentioned that he was pretty terrible to women, that he was kind of right in their faces, that I've heard from multiple people that when he was in high school, he would like moon girls in the hallways, that when he was older, he would just like talk to women in bars and like wouldn't go away. And that, yeah, the people I've talked to, you know, the people who can, most people I talk to who can, like, remember his lines and recite bits that he did, it's mostly guys. That women were not as into it. And certainly the women I know who knew him and met him in, you know, in a bar or something like that, were like, yeah, he was, I mean, you know, they admitted he was funny. They said, yeah, he was, you know, he was funny, and you could see that, but he was also kind of a jerk. I think Janet's spot on there.
Are there any under the radar Farley sketches or movies that folks should check out this weekend?
Wow. Gosh, I really can't think of anything. I mean, I was trying to go back and kind of see the hits. He was not known for his indie filmmaking work.
No.
He was, by the time anyone heard of him, he was on SNL. I don't think any of his performances at the Arc here in Madison, when he was in his early 20s, were filmed and archived and released or anything like that. He was just so big. He was in the spotlight.
We just have a minute here in this segment before we have to let you go and make way for Wisconsin Life. But what was Chris Farley's legacy in the comedy world? What did he leave behind very quickly?
Wow. I think the main thing was he left behind a cautionary tale. I looked at, I think it was the Wisconsin State Journal ran a feature on his death, and they showed some of the photos from his funeral where the cast of SNL at that time came, many of them came back to Madison. And, you know, on all their faces, there's this kind of look like, what have we done? You know, what it seemed like everybody in that shot, Tim Meadows and Adam Sandler and the other cast members were all kind of thinking, oh, wow, something's gone horribly off. So I think that's his big legacy, is sort of a cautionary tale of what happens to a kind of, you know, Midwestern doofus who makes it big.
And we'll leave it there. Jonathan Pollack, thank you so much for spending time with us this hour. Jonathan Pollack is a history instructor and pop culture expert at Madison Area Technical College. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Gig posters are an indispensable visual pairing for live music. As an art form, posters took off in the mid to late 60s, their hand-drawn, psychedelic-style key to shaping the visual identity of that era. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the plane crash that killed Otis Redding on his way to a Madison gig. Christian Knutson tells us about the poster created for the show that never happened.
Concert posters are a common sight around Central Madison, particularly along State Street, near the UW campus, and on Willie Street. They're ephemeral, covered over quickly by new layers of promotion. In late 2007, though, a striking gig poster caught my eye in an art gallery on State Street. It was a poster for what would become the most enduring story in Madison music history, a concert by Otis Redding that wasn't to be. The youthful soul and R&B musician, only 26 years old, met a tragic demise when his small plane plummeted into the icy waters of Lake Monona on December 10, 1967. Redding and all but one member of his band, the Bar K's, died in this crash. En route from Cleveland, they were set to play a pair of shows that night at the Factory, a long-gone venue just off State Street. It was the end of a big year for Redding. His cover, Try Little Tenderness, was a recent hit, and he'd brought the house down at the Monterey Pop Festival in June. That summer, a cover of his song, Respect, climbed and climbed, hitting the top of the chart. Indeed, Aretha Franklin's immortal version would become one of the all-time greatest American recordings. As 1967 wound down, Redding hit the studios to record, and then the road again to perform. I've always loved gig posters, but the one for Redding's stop in Madison is a particularly melancholy artifact of rock and roll history. Around 2 feet high and not quite as wide, the print is a single layer, black ink on blue stock for some copies, yellow for others. Its design is divided in two vertically, with text on the left and an illustration to the right. The left side reads, Otis Redding at the Factory, one night only, providing the date, time, and price, along with an opener, The Grim Reapers. Macabre in hindsight, that was an early band led by Rockford's Rick Nielsen, who would go on to fame as the frontman of Cheap Trick. The typeface is loose and flowing, like that used for Metropolitan signage above Paris subway stations. The right half is a drawing of a woman blanketed in foliage and shielded by a rectangular screen of wavy flowing lines. Only her steepled hands and head with flowing black tresses visible. Near the bottom is a single word, tenderness, and a stylized broken heart. The poster was created by William Barr, a sophomore at UW that year. He said the design was meant to be an allegory for the idea of tenderness, a woman gazing upon the wounded soul of her beloved. The poster's design bears a distinct resemblance to the cover of the self-titled debut album by the British prog band Procol Harum. It had been released a couple of months earlier and opened with their Summer of Love-defining hit A Whiter Shade of Pale. That typeface is similarly sinuous, the image likewise centered on an apparitional female figure wreathed in tightly drawn leaves, all in black and white. Both posters evoke Art Nouveau illustrations. About 100 posters total were printed for the show. After the crash, those that hadn't already been claimed were. It was reprinted in 1981, and in decades since, the originals would become coveted rarities. Only weeks after his death, Redding's new song, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, was released. That single topped the charts and ensured his place in the pantheon of American music. Redding's song Endure. And while the poster for his would-be show in Wisconsin is but a footnote, it too memorializes his sound and soul.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Thank you, Erica. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Cheryl Gasser. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. We had technical assistance this morning from Michelle Good as well. It really does take a village to raise a talk show. Coming up Monday at this time, from the mundane to the brutal, disappointing to comforting, women across cultures illuminate what home means. That's Monday morning after 6. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. Stick around. More to come on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.